aim and target of which was to target the resistance in Lebanon. Then you had 2006, which is the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. But you know, whoever stood in the face of the resistance has always been defeated. And Hezbollah in Lebanon is part and parcel of the fabric. It is a community. It has a large swathe of constituency. And we have to understand something, speaking of constituency, is that we are very soon approaching the elections in Lebanon, the parliamentary elections. And whatever we see, any kind of instability, any kind of events, is going to be in order to try and tip the balance of elections, because the Lebanese forces, they know for sure that, you know, former member of parliament Walid Jumblatt is no longer allying with them in Baabda and Ashouf, and he said so clearly. And also Al-Hariri, which is the future bloc, is not aligned with them in the Akka region, in the Hirmil, and somewhere else. So they are, according to this new electoral law, they'll be losing a lot of seats in the forthcoming elections. And whatever they have done, Richard, they opened their own fire at themselves. This is not something that is going to pass easily. The blood of the martyrs is not going to stay on the streets. There's going to be a kind of accountability, a solid accountability, a vendetta also, not only from those particular people, the way, you know, those people who were also responsible for the events that took place in Khaldi and the killing, the cold blood killing of the people in Khaldi, and those who were also the next day in the funeral procession. Their masters, who are the servants of another master, which is a master that was and is always defeated today, defeated in Afghanistan, defeated in Iraq, defeated in Syria, defeated elsewhere, is also going to be defeated in Lebanon, Richard, sooner rather than later.
Zainab, when you speak of their masters, this is a very important point. What role do the United States, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Israel, what role do they play in this attack and in Lebanese politics in general? Is it true, for example, that the Lebanese forces militia was training in Saudi Arabia? You know, what else is the American embassy? What role does the American ambassador play in all this? And what goal are they trying to achieve here? You mentioned destabilizing the elections as one example. Is this also part of a plan to weaken the axis of resistance, to disarm Hezbollah? What about Lebanon's gas and natural resources?
Of course, everything that the Americans have been doing in the region and also in Lebanon in particular, the sanctions against Lebanon, the sanctions against lots of personalities who are allied with the resistance in Lebanon, it's a mode of trying to weaken the resistance in Lebanon and trying to turn the people of Lebanon, the people of the resistance, against their own resistance. And, you know, the American ambassador has been doing all this witchcraft, if I might say, all these kind of suspicious and all these kind of, you know, the imperial moves trying to control Lebanon and the Lebanese institutions. But she's failing. And, you know, the moment Hezbollah tried to get the ship of fuel from Iran, the next day she said that, well, we're going to get gas from Egypt through Syria. Syria that was sanctioned by the very Americans through the Caesar law. They broke the Caesar law and, you know, and she was reprimanded by her administration, saying that, well, you don't need this Sayyid Nasrallah to do something, and then you have to retaliate the next day to show that you are strong and flexing your muscles. But anyways, she is doing her best. She is on the line of the Pompeo recommendation, still trying to, in her dreams, she dreams a lot that she dreams of disbanding and disarming Hezbollah and, you know, dismantling this kind of party and the people of it, and turning the people of the resistance and the quote-unquote Shia against Hezbollah. Well, this is just in your dreams. These are chimeras, and this is something that can never be true. Regarding the fact that we heard yesterday a very important statement by the mother of the martyr, Maryam Farhat, in yesterday events, in the massacre that took place yesterday, she said, well, they are not going to move us one iota against the resistance. We know those scenarios. We know what the play, this theatrical thing that is taking place against us. We know the ultimate aims of, and we're not going to move. That's why the people of Lebanon yesterday, and I say the people of Lebanon, the true, honest people of Lebanon, they were not being dragged to a kind of civil war, to a kind of sedition, to a kind of discord, because whatever took place, it's not so much strange to us. We know these scenarios, and nobody can drag us again to a civil war.
Zainab El-Safar, thank you so much for your time. It's really a pleasure having your insightful knowledge and graceful presentation on the program. Really great speaking with you.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Richard. Thank you very much.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
In order to understand the Tayuni massacre that just took place in Beirut, we have to understand the general context of Lebanon's political situation. As we've covered before on the program, Lebanon is under a de facto U.S. siege, its economy in turmoil, and as such, Lebanon remains a very fragile nation in need of political reform. As of recently, Hezbollah has been importing shipments of fuel from Iran to Lebanon, defying not only U.S. sanctions, but also its political rivals inside the country, making them look weak and incompetent as Hezbollah bolsters its image and popularity with the Lebanese people. There are elections coming up soon in Lebanon, and political parties like Jaja's Lebanese forces want to manipulate public opinion against Hezbollah because of their weak standing and the recent political humiliations that they suffer. External actors like the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates have been trying to dismantle Hezbollah for a long time, especially after Hezbollah successfully liberated South Lebanon from Israeli occupation and drove the Israeli invaders back in 2006. The aim of the Tayuni massacre was twofold. One, murdering its supporters to try and provoke Hezbollah into retaliation. The United States, Israel, and Hezbollah's rivals in Lebanon want to paint Hezbollah not as a resistance group, but as some violent armed gang. They want to paint it as an organization that uses violence against its own people so they can try and disarm the group. That way, Hezbollah's political rivals can ascend to power inside Lebanon. The Israelis would no longer face any resistance if they attack or invade Lebanon and Syria. And the United States can go on funding Takfiri terrorists in the region and invading the Middle East with less opposition. So the first aim was to vilify Hezbollah, try and disarm them. The second aim of this massacre was to create sectarian tensions and plunge Lebanon into civil war. Hezbollah and Amal decided not to do either of those things, hence preventing the country from descending into chaos. Let us be clear, everyone has weapons in Lebanon. The difference, however, between the fascist Lebanese forces militia and Hezbollah is that Hezbollah never turns its guns on its own people. It uses them to defend Lebanon from foreign invaders and colonizers. Hezbollah is an integral part of the Axis of Resistance and is allied with Syria, Iran, and the popular mobilization forces in Iraq. So let's examine the events of the past week, because in Syria was bombed twice by Israel and the United States, who struck locations in Homs, south of the ancient, the beautiful city of Palmyra, killing one Syrian soldier and wounding three others. In Afghanistan, two suicide bombers struck mosques in Kunduz and Kandahar during Friday prayers, leaving over 100 people wounded or killed, most of the victims Shia Muslims of the Hazara ethnic minority. And then finally in Lebanon, this tragic massacre with snipers firing at peaceful protesters, again, most of them Shia Muslims and supporters of the resistance. All these things point to a concerted effort by the West and its regional allies to destabilize Lebanon, to provoke sectarian violence and start a civil war. They want to pit Muslims against Christians, Shia against Sunni, and destroy the multi-ethnic, multi-religious fabric of Lebanon. Amal and Hezbollah supporters were specifically targeted by fascists who have a long history of murder, and the mainstream media are trying to downplay this and hide it from you. But this plan of theirs to turn people against one another, to weaken Lebanon's security and weaken the axis of resistance, is not going to work. Their intent was clear from the beginning, and this is precisely why Hezbollah and Amal told people not to retaliate. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
فقال الله الحكيم في كتابه المبين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولقد آتيناك السبع من المثاني والقرآن العظيم. My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And so tonight I want to look in the second topic for this evening at Surah Al-Fatiha, the key to the solution of all of our problems. Now, the verse that I began with comes to us from chapter number 15, Surah Al-Hijr, verse number 87. It's a very interesting verse, it's very short. In it, Allah says, وَلَكَدْ أَتَيْنَاكَ سَبْعًا مِنَ الْمَثَانِي وَالْقُرْآنِ الْعَظِيمِ. Indeed, we have given to you, O Muhammad, the seven often repeated verses, Sab'an min al-Mathani, wal-Quran al-Azim, and the great Quran, this Quran which Allah describes as Azim, as something which is tremendous, which is something which is great. Now, this particular verse of the Quran is interesting on many fronts. And I want to lead into my topic tonight by this verse of the Quran. As we said, that I want to look at Surah Al-Fatiha tonight and how it is and it presents the solution to all of our problems today as believers, as human beings. Now, this verse, as I said, from chapter 15, verse 87, where Allah tells the Prophet that indeed we have given you the sab'an min al-mathani, the seven often repeated verses. Our scholars, the scholars of commentary of Quran who follow the tradition of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, they have said that one of the interpretations, if not the prime meaning of this verse in their estimation, in their understanding, is Surah Al-Fatiha, the Sab'an min al-Mathani. That's the main opinion. There are other opinions that it refers to seven of the largest chapters of the Quran. But the opinion that we look at tonight is that this refers to Surah Al-Fatiha. And if you look at it in this verse, it's interesting because Allah is saying, we have given you, O Rasul, sab'an min al-mathani, these seven often repeated verses, wal-Quran al-azim. What Allah is saying here is Allah is putting whatever these seven often repeated verses are at the same level as the entire Quran. Sab'an min al-mathani, wal-Quran al-azim, on the other hand. Two of these become equal in weight. And we'll see in our discussion tonight how this is a reality and how this chapter needs to be infused within our lives. Now, just a few points about this before I go to the main area of discussion for this evening. If this is the interpretation which our scholars have given is accurate, that the Sab'an min al-Mathani are the seven verses of Surah Al-Fatiha, we know that this is the most often recited chapter of the Quran. A minimum of 10 times every day, you and I recite Surah Al-Fatiha. In fact, we have the very famous hadith of our Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, where he says, La salat illa bi fatihat al-kitab. That there is no salat except with the Fatiha, with the opening chapter of the Quran. And you know, just as a side note, in terms of the ahkam, the fiqh, the jurisprudence, if you are in a situation, let's say you don't have much time, the time for, let's say you came home late from school or work and your time for asr or dhuhr is very limited, the scholars tell us, the maraja say that if you need, you can drop the second surah. But Surah Fatiha has to be recited. So you might say, well, I don't have time to recite the two surahs because of this emergency. And in certain circumstances, that is allowed to be dropped. But Fatiha til Kitab is always there. It is a part, integral part of the daily prayers of a believer. Another reason why our scholars tell us that this chapter is so important is it was revealed twice to Rasulullah. You know, I would say that all of the rest of the Quran, from my understanding, was revealed one time to the Prophet. Meaning, if when Surah Al-Kawthar came to the Prophet, it came down one time. When Surah Al-Kafirun was revealed to Rasulullah, it was revealed one time. But Surah Al-Fatiha is so important that Allah revealed it twice to Rasulullah. Once in Mecca, and incidentally this was the first complete chapter of the Quran to be revealed, and once in Medina. Now you and I know, and when we go and we teach our children about the basics of Islam, that the very first verse to come down to Rasulullah was the first verses of Surah Al-Alaq, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Iqra, Bismi Rabbikal Ladhi Khalaq, Khalaqal Insana Min Alaq. That was the first revelation, the first wahi to Rasulullah. But that's not the first chapter that was revealed. It was not revealed in complete form. Surah Al-Fatiha was revealed in complete form, full totality, seven verses, to Rasulullah. So let me just mention this as we move on, that this first verse of Surah Al-Fatiha, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, this is a verse like no other. And unfortunately, amongst the Muslim community, there is such a diversity of opinion that sometimes it leaves you scratching your head that where do the scholars get these opinions from? Now, let me first at the outset say this, as Shia Ithna Ashari, Imami Shias, we follow the 12 Imams from Imam Ali to Imam Al-Mahdi. May Allah bless all of them and may Allah hasten the return of our 12th Imam. All of our ulama are unanimous that the basmala, the phrase Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, is a independent part of every surah of the Quran. So yes, it's written at the top of every verse or every surah, except for chapter number 9, Surah Tawbah. But it is a part of that chapter. We might not count it as verse number 1, but it is a part of the surah. And as we know, it is an obligation. It is wajib to recite that phrase Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim when we recite the Quran, specifically in the Salat. Now, should you recite the Bismillah if you're just at home reading Quran? It's better to recite it for the barakah of it, because of the fact that the chapter was revealed with it. We should recite the Bismillah as well. But without a doubt, in the Salat, in the daily prayers for men and women, it is an obligation to recite the Bismillah. Now, do we recite it out loud, like I'm speaking right now, as we pray Fajr, Maghrib, and Isha? Or do we recite it quietly, like we do when we recite Salatul Dhuhr and Asr? Obviously, we know that for Fajr, Maghrib, and Isha, it's recited, we are highly advised to recite it out loud in an audible voice for men. For women, if there are non-mahram men present, then it is not allowed for them to recite this out loud or any of the adhkar out loud. But for men, we have to recite it, we should recite it out loud. And obviously the chapters of the Quran, as for men, for the three prayers, Fajr, Maghrib, and Isha, must be recited out loud. Now, the reason I bring this up, and I say and I emphasize on this point, that we have to recite these out loud. And we know we have the hadith also, just incidentally, from the 11th Imam, Imam Al-Askari, alayhi salatu wassalam, in which he tells us that the alamat of the Shia, or the alamat of the believer, are five. One of them is a ziyarat of Arba'een, wearing a ring on the right hand, putting the forehead on the dust of on dirt when we go into sajda, belief in the mi'raj of the Prophet being a physical mi'raj. And the one thing he says is to recite the Bismillah jahran in a open voice.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for being with us again on another episode of The Lantern. Alhamdulillah rabbil alameen that we've been given this chance and opportunity. I hope you guys find that the little discussions we have on the show beneficial. I hope that there are some positive takeaways, some positive points, some, you know, little reminders. I'm not saying I'm saying anything new or anything, but sometimes we need reminders. And this is first and foremost a reminder for myself. Aside from the fact that I have the attention span of a miniature teaspoon, I also feel that every time I speak about these things, like every time I go through the process of preparing for them, looking through the ahadith and the ayat, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Oh yeah, I had totally forgotten this. Oh yeah, good point. Oh yeah, I should think about that more. Oh yeah, you know what? I'm gonna write that down. And it's firstly really, you know, useful for me. And I hope you guys, I don't know. Thanks for bothering. Anyway, you know, one of the things that children do a lot is comparing. I don't even want to start with parents that compare their children with other children in front of their children. It's really detrimental for the child's mental health and growth. Please don't do that. Just stop right now. It's borderline child abuse. But children also often have a habit of comparing the things that they have with other people. And that's one of the reasons why a great degree of equality and equity is very important for parents to establish among their children, among the siblings. But then on the other hand, it's also important for us to train our kids in a way that they would not constantly look at what their peers have. Like we come across children that come back from a birthday party and they start pouting and sulking and throwing a fit that, oh, the other kid had a better cake, had a better this, had a better that, and I don't have anything, and they throw their toys around, and like, all of my stuff suck, and I don't want them anymore, and you're the worst parent in the world, and yada, yada, yada. Let's listen to a short story about this, and we're going to be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salam, peace and salutations of Allah the Almighty be upon all of you. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story. It starts like this. A group of highly established alumni got together to visit their old university professor. The conversation among them soon turned into complaints about their stressful work and life. The professor went to his kitchen and returned with a large pot of coffee in an assortment of cups, including porcelain, plastic, glass, crystal, some plain-looking, some expensive, and some exquisite. The professor told them to help themselves to the coffee. After all the students had a cup of coffee in their hands, the professor said, "Did you notice all the nice-looking cups are taken and only the plain inexpensive ones are left behind? While it is normal for everyone to want the best for themselves, but that is the source of problems and stress in your life. The cup itself adds no quality to the coffee. In most of the cases, it's just more expensive and hides what we drink," the professor continued. "What all of you really wanted was coffee, not the cup. But all of you consciously went for good-looking expensive cups and then began eyeing on each other's cups. Let's consider that life is the coffee and the jobs, houses, cars, things, money, and position are the cups. The type of the cup we have does not define or change the quality of our lives. Now, what is the moral of this story for today? Sometimes we fail to enjoy the coffee by concentrating only on the cup we have. Being happy doesn't mean everything around you is perfect. It means you've decided to see beyond the imperfections and find peace. And the peace lies within you, not in your career, jobs, or the houses you have."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Once we create balance, that sort of equilibrium in our lives, we will find a lot of, you know, positive manifestations occur. And we will find ourselves in a more comfortable zone of growth. We will not constantly be riddled with anxiety and a sense of doom and failure because we're not doing well enough. we will be reminded that all that matters is that we do our best. I personally think it so does matter in what kind of cup you drink your coffee or tea. But the moral of the story is that at the end of the day, it's just a vessel. It's not going to bring down the worth of what we are consuming. If you put liquid gold, liquid gold is usually pretty darn hot, so you can't really put it in a plastic container. But a really, really valuable perfume, right? Whether you put it in a gold chalice or a plastic cup, it's not going to do anything to the worth of that perfume or that really, really mindlessly expensive liquid. As goes to us, this is really cliche, but all that matters really is what's on the inside. Our body and our car and our home and our clothes and our degree and all of this, they're just vessels. They're just fleeting material things. They're not the objective. They're just means and tools that we utilize during different periods of our lives in order to reach that ultimate objective of our creation. And it's really important for us to be able to focus on these aspects of our lives and create a sense of mindfulness and presence for ourselves, so that we can appreciate the things that we have more, so that we could be happier with the things that we have, and so that we would not create unnecessary heartache and headache for ourselves by comparing ourselves to those whom backstory we don't really know. We see a snippet, a small glimpse of a person's life, but we see our entire history, our traumas, our wounds, our scars, our talents, our failures, our success, our awkward, cringy moments. We see all of that and we compare it to one moment of hashtag living my best life of another person. And then we neglect or we forget that we have a lot of those moments in our lives too. God knows how many times you've inspired someone, you've made them feel better, they were having a hard day and you acted as a ray of sunlight for them to be able to pick up their own pieces and get back on their feet again. God knows how many times someone found strength and courage from your words, from your random act of kindness, from your good intentions, or from the positive energy you radiate, but you often ignore or dismiss about yourself because you're focusing on your own flaws. Meanwhile, Allah is acknowledging you as His best, most beautiful creation. Don't compare yourself with anyone. The only person you get to compare yourself with, and you should, is the past version of you. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, if 2 days of yours are the same, you failed. What he means is that if you did not achieve something better today, then you didn't gain anything. And sometimes something better today is resting, healing from yesterday. Sometimes it looks like learning from yesterday. Sometimes it really is just doing better today compared to what you did yesterday in any aspect of life. Eternally, externally, spiritually, physically, mentally, you're doing well. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we looked at how the ongoing epidemic of men's violence in America is rooted in this inability as a society to move beyond outmoded ideals of manhood. In a sweeping analysis that cut across racial, ethnic, and class lines, we examined mass shootings, day-to-day gun violence, violence against women, bullying, and American militarism against the backdrop of a culture that has normalized violent and regressive forms of masculinity in the face of challenges to traditional male power and authority. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
It turns out that Lord Baden-Powell founded the Boy Scout for a very explicit reason, to counteract what he perceived as a decline in the manly virtues. In his influential book, Rovering to Success, A Guide to Young Manhood, Powell was quite explicit about this. God made men to be men, he wrote. Civilization, with its town life, buses, hot and cold water laid on, everything done for you, tends to make men soft and feckless beings. We badly need training for our lads if we are to keep up manliness in our race instead of lapsing into a nation of soft, sloppy cigarette suckers.
The Scout program is designed to help our sons, cousins, and younger brothers develop the initiative, the resourcefulness, the character, the quick thinking, and the leadership they really need in the somewhat jittery, insecure world in which we live.
Again and again at key moments in American history, you see men reacting to change in just this way by retreating into a hyper-masculine fantasy world. You see it in the rise of popular men's magazines in the 1940s, filled with stories about breathtaking manly adventures in sports. These magazines may look retro to us today, but what's important to remember is that they were just as retro in their own time. As the lives of men grew more sedentary during the consumer boom of the post-war years, as women moved into the workplace in unprecedented numbers and the women's movement gained traction, these magazines offered men a way to hit back at what Ralph Day, the editorial director of True Magazine, describes as the perils of creeping equality. Men were turning to his magazine in unprecedented numbers, Day explained to a group of men in a speech, because it stimulates his masculine ego at a time when man wants to fight back against women's efforts to usurp his traditional role as head of the family. And this backlash has only accelerated exponentially since the 1960s, when the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the anti-war movement rose up to challenge traditional masculine authority like never before, especially the authority of straight white men.
The plain truth of the matter is this has to stop, and it has to stop like the day before yesterday.
Feminism was established so that unattractive, ugly broads could have easy access to the mainstream, right? Did you see it? Yes!
Look at our political culture, where the game is all about establishing your manly credentials by butching yourself up and methodically feminizing and taking apart the manhood of your opponents.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
There was no clearer depiction of this backlash phenomenon than the film Fight Club. The movie portrayed the emasculation of young men by the consumer culture.
We're still men.
Yes, we're men. Men is what we are.
And offered up bare-knuckled violence as a way for men to reclaim their manhood. Regardless of whether we see film as a glamorization or a satire of backlash masculinity, backyard fight clubs have proliferated in the years since the film's release. And at the base of all of this is the belief that the best way for men to restore their dwindling manhood and restore order is through what the cultural historian Richard Slotkin has called the frontier myth of regenerative violence.
Most people understand that guns make you safer, especially because society is degenerating. There's going to be a lot of craziness going on. And so we need guns to protect ourselves.
To older working and middle-class white men, the message is clear.
That's the thing that gets me. If I lived on the border and some brown man came running through my backyard that looks like he didn't belong there, then why aren't people doing that?
The basic idea is that the best way to regain power and control is through a barrel of a gun, or as many guns as possible.
They're accurate.
Mm-hmm.
They are dependable.
Yes, they are. Super dependable.
They are extremely well made. You can carry plenty of them on your person at all times.
This white male paranoia and siege mentality have fueled the increasingly aggressive effort to block even the most sensible gun policies.
When the system is overwhelmed, and I mean the system on the entire planet, somebody had better be prepared to protect themselves, their families, their neighborhoods, and the freedom of all mankind. Never let them take your Second Amendment right, ever.
This siege mentality has also fueled the rise of hate groups and militias over the past quarter century.
They're not branches of Al-Qaeda. They're right-wing extremists with lots of guns and an axe to grind against the U.S. government.
Listen, people. Things are bad. Things are real bad. And it's going to get a lot worse. So basically, if people need to wake up, start buying some of these, see?
Groups like these are often described as white supremacist hate groups, which they usually are. But they can also be seen as a kind of reactionary men's movement, an organized expression of white male anxiety and aggrieved entitlement that relies on violence as the preferred means of attaining its goals.
Recovery crews are still searching the waters around an island where a gunman opened fire on young people attending a summer camp.
In recent years, perhaps the most disgusting and morally bankrupt expression of this kind of threatened entitlement was the massacre of 77 people, including 69 teenagers, perpetrated by the Norwegian right-wing fanatic Anders Breivik, a former customer service representative who had been declared unfit for service in the Norwegian army. In his 1,500-page manifesto explaining his reasons for the attack, Breivik ranted against culturalism, but he reserved special venom for feminism's role in emasculating Western men. According to Breivik, feminist ideology and political correctness have been responsible for transforming a patriarchy into a matriarchy and intend to deny the intrinsic worth of males. And by now, men have been reduced to an emasculated, touchy-feely subspecies. What this shows is that a whole lot of men out there fear they're losing control and are turning to violence to reclaim their manhood. In his fascinating study of violence, the psychiatrist James Gilligan interviewed hundreds of violent criminals in American prisons and found that the single most powerful reason they turned to violence was because they felt shamed, humiliated, or disrespected as men. The more time I spent with him, Gilligan writes about one of the hundreds of violent criminals he has interviewed over the course of his research, the clearer it became that his character served as a defense against the threat of being treated with scorn and disrespect, of being perceived as a weakling, not a real man, someone who could be laughed at. We may not hear about it much in mainstream coverage of violence, but again and again we've seen exactly this dynamic. Young men using violence to overcome the shame of not being seen and respected as real men.
16-year-old Luke Woodham entered the Commons area of Pearl High and fired off several shots.
Woodham opened fire at Pearl High School, killing two students.
Consider Luke Woodham, who carried out a school shooting in Pearl, Mississippi in the late 1990s. Woodham wrote a letter before he went on his rampage explaining himself this way. I am not insane, I am angry. I killed because people like me are mistreated every day. All throughout my life, I was ridiculed, always beaten, always hated. If I can't do it through pacifism, if I can't show you through the displaying of intelligence, then I will do it with a bullet. Murder is not weak and slow-witted. Murder is gutsy and daring.
Just minutes after firing two fatal shots at the Virginia Tech dormitory on Monday, Cho Sung-hui returned to his own dorm room and made the final preparations to mail what appears to be a video confession.
Or consider Sung-hee Cho, who committed one of the worst mass shootings in American history when he went on a shooting spree at Virginia Tech University in 2007, killing 32 people. Cho was a socially isolated, troubled young man with a history of mental health problems who had clearly bought into a cultural narrative that says the way to reclaim manhood is through projecting an image of menace and toughness, instilling fear in others, and using violence. Before he committed the Virginia Tech massacre, he wrote, produced, and starred in his own video, demonstrating how thoroughly he'd bought into this Hollywood script. Cho isn't the only mass murderer whose violent actions enabled him to rewrite the script of his life in order to place himself back in the manly starring role.
All you hear is like firecrackers, and then I looked out the window, and there's a kid with a trench coat and a shotgun throwing pipe bombs in the parking lot.
The Columbine killers, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, left behind written diaries that provide insight into how their murder of 12 classmates and a teacher was part of a conscious strategy to settle scores. In his journal, Klebold writes that he and Harris will take revenge on society. And toward the end of his own journal, Harris writes, everyone is always making fun of me because of how I look, how f***ing weak I am, and well, I will get you all back. I hate people, and they better f***ing fear me if they know what's good for them.
The shooter was 36-year-old Andrew Engeldinger, an employee of the small company who had recently lost his job.
And this isn't just about young men. Again and again, we've seen the same thing with older men who commit mass shootings.
A troubled ex-husband is under arrest in the Southern California hair salon shooting that left 8 people dead.
In case after case, these men have faced grief, bitter disappointment, and feelings of failure.
The shooter, Richard Farley, was obsessed with a female colleague. He had also been laid off.
They are either chronically unemployed, have been left by their wives or girlfriends, been fired from their jobs, or have suffered some other kind of serious blow to their self-worth as men. Nothing can excuse the pathetic and cowardly way men like these use violence and destroy the lives of innocent people to make some kind of a statement. But we're kidding ourselves if we think these killings will stop unless and until we can identify and transform the larger cultural belief systems that underlie them.
From the mass shooting in Tucson aimed at former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords to the Colorado movie theater massacre, killers in many recent mass killings suffered mental illness.
Of course, there's no question that mental illness has played a role in a lot of rampage killings and mass shootings. But what never seems to get discussed is why it is that somewhere around 98% of school shootings and rampage killings have been committed by men, even though there are plenty of young women who suffer from mental illness as well. What this tells us is that violence can't be reduced to mental illness on its own, especially since the vast majority of mentally ill people are not violent at all. The bottom line is that even men who are mentally ill live and operate within a culture that has normalized violent masculinity and defined manhood in exceedingly narrow ways.
It's been widely reported school shooter Adam Lanza suffered some kind of personality disorder.
The Sandy Hook Elementary school shooter Adam Lanza may have been mentally ill, but he played out a familiar script.
He was bullied severely, brutally bullied, when he was in elementary school at Sandy Hook.
By all accounts, he was a socially awkward boy who didn't fit in and appears to have been mercilessly bullied.
That's a clip of the video game Call of Duty. It's also the game that Adam Lanza used to play.
He developed a revenge fantasy, secured firearms, and then killed his own mother before carrying out one of the most brutal and ruthless mass killings in American history. And in his own delusional and twisted way, he would recapture the sense of respect that seemed to have eluded him his whole life. The children of Newtown, like so many other innocent victims of men's violence, became theatrical props in the performance of an aggrieved, angry, and likely self-hating young man who absorbed all the wrong lessons about what it means to be a tough, strong man from the world around him. Just take a look at the ad campaign the Bushmaster Firearms Company ran prior to the Newtown massacre for the very AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle Lanza used during his killing spree. What all of this amounts to is that our violence problem seems to be a lot less about lone wolves and monsters who fail to conform to society's norms than it is about too many men, in a sense, over-conforming to our norms and ideals of manhood out of fear of not being seen as men. When we talk about men's violence and dominant ideals of violent masculinity, there's a temptation to frame things in terms of the damage men do to others. But we need to look also at the devastating harm these norms do to men themselves. This is certainly true of gun violence. Every year in this country, over 30,000 people are killed by guns, something like 85 per day. The vast majority of these victims are men, approximately 86%. But while we're used to thinking about gun violence in terms of mass shootings and urban crime, we really don't talk a lot about how most gun deaths are the result of men and boys shooting themselves. Suicide, which is really violence turned inward, accounts for close to two-thirds of all gun deaths. The vast majority of people who kill themselves with a gun are men, and white men comprise over 80% of these firearm suicides. Violence doesn't just leave physical scars. It also leaves emotional scars. Look at the cost to African-American boys and young men of living in and around violence. Violence is the leading cause of death of African-American men between the ages of 15 and 30. But they also have much higher than average rates of depression, school dropout, mental health problems linked to perpetual stress, substance abuse. And just look at the terrible toll violence has taken on the psyches of men who serve in combat zones.
In the 5 years between 2006 and 2009, more than 1,100 members of the armed services took their own lives.
Something like half of U.S. service members who have done tours in Iraq and Afghanistan have signs of trauma, depression, flashbacks, alcohol and drug problems. In her landmark study, Trauma and Recovery, Judith Herman draws a powerful connection between the experience of male combat veterans and women who are the victims of domestic and sexual violence. The sources of the violence and their context might vary, but the unifying theme is that human beings, young and old, women and men, suffer when their physical and sexual boundaries are violated. But in the case of men, this pain gets compounded by a cultural belief system that equates manhood with invulnerability and ridicules and shames men who admit to being in emotional pain. In his classic work, I Don't Want to Talk About It, the therapist Terry Real identifies the widespread phenomenon of what he calls covert depression, a condition that roughly three-quarters of American men suffer in silence out of fear of seeming like less than a real man. For many of these men, childhood trauma and other experiences of violence play a role in this depression, which then can affect not only their ability to take care of themselves physically and emotionally, but also hinder their ability to sustain healthy relationships in adult life. Despite predictable arguments that equate trying to understand or prevent violence with weakness, the bottom line is that we have to have the strength to ask these kind of questions if we want to move beyond the never-ending cycle of violence. And that starts with examining the dominant stories we tell ourselves as a culture about manhood and violence, and demanding more honest and accurate representations of the personal and societal consequences of violent masculinity. War movies like Saving Private Ryan showed not only the awe-inspiring courage of the men who stormed the beaches in Normandy and fought totalitarianism during World War II. The film also captured the panic, anxiety, and sheer terror of the young men who experienced that war.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it.
I do.
I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
More recently, The Hurt Locker explored another devastating effect of battlefield trauma. Showing how the intensity and violence of war make it difficult for many veterans to adjust back to civilian life. And we saw the same kind of honest and tragic portrayal of dominant masculinity in the film The Wrestler, starring Mickey Rourke as an over-the-hill professional wrestler whose body was ravaged by physical injury and who was so emotionally damaged by violence that he couldn't imagine life outside the glamour of the arena. Intensely realistic shows like HBO's The Wire have refused to glamorize urban street life and violent crime, directly confronting the costs young men of color too often pay for their investment in the idea that respect comes only at the business end of a Glock. And we've seen emotionally complex shows like The Sopranos, which centered on brutal mob boss Tony Soprano, a ruthless killer who intimidated everyone around him, but also portrayed him as a deeply troubled man who had recurring panic attacks and who had to battle his own anxiety and self-doubt when he turned to a woman therapist for help.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know is once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction...
And then there's Good Will Hunting, which catapulted Matt Damon to fame, with Damon playing the role of an intellectually gifted working-class tough guy who relieves the trauma of his abusive childhood by hardening himself to the world and fighting anyone who challenges him. With the support of a woman who loves him and a therapist he comes to trust, finds the courage to battle through his defenses, look inside himself, and let go of his bottled-up rage. After the Newtown Massacre, there was a lot of tough guy talk about how the cure for our violence problem is yet more violence.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
But there were other men who spoke in the wake of Newtown as well. Men like Neil Heslin, whose six-year-old son Jesse was among the 20 children gunned down that tragic day.
He was my son, he was my buddy, he was my best friend.
What was so important about his testimony was that he went beyond expressing grief for his son and directly challenged the culture of violence. Too often we define masculine strength by who can blow away the most people, who can flex the most muscle, who can impose their will and inflict the most damage. But this cheapens the real definition of strength and toughness. We respect the toughness of firefighters who rush into burning buildings when others are rushing out, police officers and other first responders who put their lives on the line, not because they're out to prove something, but because they steel themselves in the face of danger and face down their fears in service to others. For the same reason, we should respect the toughness and strength of men who challenge the myth that being a real man requires putting up a false front, disrespecting others, and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Strength is about adapting to change, not about retreating from it and lashing back with violence out of fear. And it's high time we had a definition of manhood capable of meeting that challenge.
While the program helped to diagnose the root causes of America's increasing levels of hypermasculinity, bullying, and gun violence, as well as the correlation between violence and manhood. But it seems that changing this culture, which is rooted so deeply in grotesque models of violence, is easier said than done. That's it for this week. Do join us next week here on Aperture. Until another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahali, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, issues, and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are based upon the Holy Quran and of the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our guest speaker and dear friend, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, thank you for joining us, and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Dear Sayyid, our topic today is about how we should understand our children and how we should also deal with the problems our children are facing, and how we should always be proactive and not simply reactive when we want to discuss problems and other circumstances and obstacles our children face. And we also said very importantly last time that when we are treating the problems or the problems we see in our children, to not treat the problem as or equating the problem to the child himself, rather that this problem is something that the child also is facing. So basically, you are a team and you are in this together.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajum. So we said there are a few things that a parent need to understand about the children, just as a way of being able to cope and deal with the child.
Right.
Among the things that we need to pay attention to when it comes to our children, we need to understand which of his senses is more active in him. Because with children, a human being in general, each one of us would have one of his senses being the most dominant and most active. Some people are visual, some people go by hearing, and some people go by the touch. So, for example, you can have a child in a class that does not look at his teacher, for example, doesn't pay attention, or his eye is always going somewhere else.
Right.
That the teacher, if he looks at him, he thinks this child is distracted and not paying attention.
Right.
But the minute he asks him, he finds out, no, the child actually following with the class.
He is listening, just not looking at
him. Exactly. So right. Sometimes you find them in that kind of category, and sometimes you find a child, no, when it comes to his hearing, is stronger. Sometimes the child, his visual is stronger. Sometimes the child would need a touch. So
they're always fidgeting with something.
Yeah, so each one of these things, it has a different personality. So understanding that itself, it gives you a door and a window into your child's personality and into your child's psyche, as we say. So if I can find out that is my child, is he visual or is he hearing or is he a person who likes a touch, for example, a touching person, then you get to know more about your child's personal likes and dislikes and how to deal with him. Because then, at the end of the day, like I said, each child has a different way of dealing with things.
Right. And on that note, they said we will go on a quick break.
I am a Muslim, Islam my deen. Allah my Lord, His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet, peace be upon